Before we start the show, we'd like to make a couple of disclaimers. This show covers a wide range of mental health topics, including suicide. So take care when listening. Check the show notes for organisations and people that can help. Also, while we discuss our own tips on staying well, this show is not meant to be a substitute for professional advice. Take care. Enjoy. Hello and welcome back to episode 2 of David F. Ward, Bipolar and I. In episode 1, you would have heard us talk about my early life, childhood, school life, early 20s, and really starting to struggle with depression in my early 20s, taking myself to the Lake District to actually hang myself. And then stuff, I don't know about brightening up, but kind of moving forward, I thought, you know, if I go away traveling / touring, doing stand-up, it would make my life better. And now we're back in 2017 and we go from here, and that's probably where the worst phase of my life actually was. And I'm back, I'm pleased to say, back with Lara Cross as well.
Lazzy C in the house.
Lazzy C?
Yeah. That's it's a new one. I mean, you haven't heard that one before.
You should have told me that you was going to do that beforehand because I would have advised not to. Lazzy C, how you been?
Yeah, I've been good, you know. Yeah. Some nice weather today.
Lovely. It's lovely. It's getting a bit hot in the studio.
It's getting a bit hot in here for more than one reason.
Yeah, it is hot. That threw me. Don't say shit. Right. So we're
Take
in 2017.
Minute.
Yeah?
We're in 2017. You've come back from Australia. You noticed out there that you weren't happy.
Yeah, and this is when shit starts to really hit the fan, because I had just done all these shows in the biggest comedy clubs around Southeast Asia and the Australia continent. And I was flying, I was buzzing, I'm earning a living wage through stand-up. And I get back to the UK, I start emailing in comedy clubs and I'm getting nothing. I'm not even getting like rejection emails, I'm just getting blanked. And it was such a bitter pit. It was like a crash down to earth in a way, because I was like, I was just doing the Comedy Store in Sydney, you know, with the guy from Breaking Bad. And I'm sitting on the stairs with the guy from Breaking Bad, just drinking beer, chatting absolute waffle. And then I can't even get like an open spot at my local comedy club. It's like, it doesn't make any sense. And I was still at this point getting flown around the, like all over the place. I think within 4 days of landing back from Southeast Asia, I was off to Amsterdam to do shows at the comedy club there. And
Were you being contacted by people?
Yeah. Oh, well, within 2 weeks or maybe within a month of coming back from Southeast Asia, I went and did a tour of South Africa. I was there for just over a fortnight doing the comedy clubs in Joburg, Durban and Cape Town. And I'm like, I'm staying in these like 5-star hotels, but I can't even get a gig in my own country. And it was frustrating because it's not as if I was shit. I knew I wasn't shit. I obviously wasn't shit.
Yeah.
Because people are paying me to fly to South Africa.
Yeah.
But then it come back to, I couldn't, and it was a real crash down to earth and I couldn't get it. And I got engaged while we were away. That was one of the things just before we left Australia. I proposed. It was the thing I wanted to do. I was with my ex about 5 years at this point.
How did you propose?
I mean, I think God was saying like, bro, this ain't gonna work out, you know.
Why? Tell me.
Because we
had you know this, I love The Bachelor.
We had this Airbnb on the coast, St Kilda Beach, right, just outside Melbourne.
Yeah.
And it was a Airbnb with a balcony facing the sea. Right?
Yeah.
Lovely. So we sit there, we drink some wine on the balcony. Watch sun going down and I'm like, there's a beach restaurant and I've already booked, and I called ahead and I was like, I'm gonna propose, get champagne on the thing, congratulations on the table.
Baller moves.
So I'm like, we're leaving now. I walk down the coast, and the thing about Australia and Melbourne in particular, and unless you've been there to experience this, the weather can change in an instant.
Yeah, sounds a bit like the UK.
But no, I'm talking like extreme in an instant. because it's on the, because of where Melbourne is, the northerly, the southerlies, the wind changes, it brings a different, it must have been about a 20 minute walk down to this beach restaurant along the beach, right?
Yeah.
It changed from beautiful sun to icy rain.
Wow.
Wind, rain, cold. And I knew that I couldn't not do it because when we get to the restaurant, there's champagne and congratulations, everyone's waiting.
Yeah.
So I just had to do it. So I did it. It was like cold. Some joggers are running past saying congratulations. I'm like, let's just get into the restaurant, right? And maybe that was like God being like, this is a mistake, you know?
Yeah, like Noah's Ark. Yeah, like, Noah's don't Ark. Do it. Yeah, yeah.
Just get a couple of lions. Do you know what I mean? And it was...
He's like, prepare yourself.
Yeah. And...
Poor girl.
Yeah. And then what? So that's how I got engaged. So I got engaged when I was in Australia. I come back. Now, before we went away, I said to my ex's dad, obviously, I asked for permission.
Yeah.
As tradition says, which is so outdated and bullshit. And I sat down and I sat with him and I said, listen, when we go away, I'm going to ask for her, you know, her to marry me. I want your permission. And he didn't even make eye contact with me. He swished his wine, looking at his wine over his glasses. And he went, only if you keep her in the life that she's accustomed to. And at the time, because I was like nervous asking that question, I was like, yeah, of course, yeah, no worries, no worries about that, son. And
what do you think he meant by that?
Well, she was a girl of privilege, private school, you know, a nice 2-3 holidays a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she didn't come from a sack of potato for a week and a family.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he meant. He meant keep her happy in terms of her holidays, her rich lifestyle. That's what he meant.
Yeah.
But I come back and every,
but
like...
just before, like when he said that, what impact did that have on you?
At the time, I didn't think, like, honestly, I didn't think anything of it. Because I was like, yeah, yeah, cool. Because you're just nervous to get, you're over the line. You want to get permission, right? You're over the line, innit? I'm fucking home dry. I'm just like,
I love that.
Football scars.
For you ladies out there.
I'm over the line, boy. Yeah, baby. And And then I didn't think anything of it. And then we went away, and you know, there was downs, but you know, I was away, and it was nice. And I come back, and I couldn't get shows. Like, really struggling to make ends meet. That what he said to me when I asked permission became so prominent in my head. It became so prominent, and it was getting me really down. I was getting ill again, you know. And and it's crazy how your body, like I spoke earlier about, I was getting tonsillitis a lot. How your body, from a mental condition, can have such a physical effect.
Yeah, I mean, with that as well, I think depending on where you come from and how like accepted mental health is a thing, like I don't know how based this is in science, but I'm pretty sure that people can then translate mental health difficulties into being physically ill because that's more accepted.
Yeah,
and that's okay.
Yeah, maybe, but it got to a point where like I couldn't keep her with the life that she's accustomed to. And then we were living back with her parents and they were retired, so they were there a lot, and I was like struggling to find work. I'd cry most mornings. There was a gap between our bed and the wall, small gap, but you could sit down and crouch down beside it, and I'd cry down there. I'd be so scared to leave my room. I wouldn't want to leave my room. I'd go down for food, and I'd be feel scared making food in their house.
Oh.
My mental health was so bad at that stage. The point where I said to you recently, I was actually looking for a new kettle on Amazon, and I saw the same kettle that they had in that kitchen,
mm-hmm.
and that brought me back to that feeling of that dread and that sadness and that I just felt so trapped in my own life in this moment. I couldn't, and then I didn't know what to do. I got a part time job in the local pub, actually before that I went to the doctors.
Mm-hmm.
So, I didn't know what to do, and I went to the, it got to a point where I remember saying to her mum one time, she goes, are you depressed again? And not in a condescending way.
Yeah.
She was genuinely like cared, and I said really bad, like suicidal, and then I just ran in my bedroom, and that must have been horrible for her to hear.
Yeah. Did your ex know you were suicidal? Or happened?
I would. Yeah, she knew that I had been. Yeah, she did. And, but it was just, I just didn't get that. I went to the doctors. You know, I lived actually literally next door to a doctor's.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there and I went to see three different doctors. One gave me a tick list. Said, oh yeah, you're depressed. And they all it was, I would go to the doctor. I would always go to the doctor,
mm-hmm.
and I would talk about the times that I was suicidal and low.
Yeah.
But I would never talk about the times where I was happy.
Yeah.
Because why would I?
Yeah.
Like, why would you go to the doctor and go, all right, doc, yeah, I've been really happy lately.
Yeah.
You know, it just, because I never associate the two being, you know, interlinked.
Yeah, you didn't have that knowledge.
No, I didn't.
It.
So I would go and be like, yeah, last week I was crying every morning and I want to kill myself.
No, like depression.
And then the week before that, I was like dancing around Tesco's, singing down, using a Battenberg as a microphone, you know, because that isn't, you know, quote, for want of a better term, normal in a way.
Yeah.
But for me, it is, because I'm always like, ah, I'm a character. I'm a comic. Oh, look at me. Look at me. Look at me dancing around Tesco. What a character I am. But actually, it was deeper than that.
And the thing is, I think as well with, you know, GPs, obviously they have to see, they deal with a lot. They're doing physical, they're doing mental health, and they actually don't diagnose a condition like bipolar. But that needs to be done by a psychiatrist currently. But you therefore need people on the front line like the GPs. I mean, they do have to manage so much. But
I know that they're doing some more training in the field now.
Yeah, it's getting people to be able to ask around more than, do you feel low?
Yeah.
And because then you don't get a full picture.
I would go there and then they would give me antidepressants. And if you have bipolar, antidepressants on their own will make you worse. Is it, it may have been known. I'm not sure if it's every case, but can, and for me, made me worse. So as far as I was aware, I went to the doctors, I asked for help, I got help, and it didn't work. Now, what the fuck else am I going to do? Like, what, I can't, you know, and I went back to the doctor. I mean,
so you're taking medication, you get given medication, you're taking it as prescribed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what else am I meant to do? And I was like, well, there's obviously not a lot of hope out there. I got a part-time job in the local pub and, yeah, I got a part-time job in the local pub, which I felt like a failure, because I'm like, I'm a fucking stand-up. Like, you know, I was getting a bit of a following at this stage because I started doing Tottenham podcasting, and that was such an escape. Like, again, that was an escape for me. I used to listen to this podcast when I was in Australia, and next thing I know, I'm on it. And it was like, I felt proud about that.
Yeah.
And it was an escape for me. So I'd go and do that. But I started to self-medicate. With, you know, alcohol, with sex addiction was back, and I was convinced that I was started looking at like sex sites again. I just wasn't being honest with my fiance now,
because just to reiterate, like, for you, sex was a form of medication.
Yeah.
Because it brought you that feeling that you were looking for.
Yeah,
at the time.
It did. Sex. Not so much booze, but I was boozing a lot because just boozing the nights away. Like, I did a lot of stuff that I look back on with regret. Like, I used to say to my ex, because we've been engaged now together a long time, and she would talk about kids, and I would just shut it down. I'd be like, no, I don't want kids.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't even like let her, like, when she's like, why? I was like, oh, don't want kids. My mum's a childminder. I've been around kids the whole life. Kids are annoying. I don't want kids. And like, to her, that must have sounded like been like a dagger, because you're like, you're with somebody, you want to have kids, you're going to go marry somebody, you want to have kids.
Yeah.
And next thing I know, and I just wish that I was honest, and I wasn't honest, because the honesty was, I didn't want to have kids because I didn't know what the fuck was wrong with me, and I didn't want to pass it on.
Really?
You know, I didn't want to pass it on, or at this stage, I was toying with the thought of suicide already. Like I said in the previous episode, it's always been such a comfort to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the times of low, I was like, you know what? You can just kill yourself. And it's like I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. It's kind of like, you don't have to have all these like bugs on your face. You can just say the words.
And for people,
and you're out.
Yeah. And for people listening who don't have, you know, mental health conditions or haven't been there, imagine the pain that you need to be in to hold that as a comfort.
Mm. Yeah, because everything in your body, your heart's pumping now, like your lungs are going, and you got all these organisms. Everything is working to keep you alive, because that's all we want to do. We want to survive. We want to live, and to have in a mindset where you think you want to take all that away.
Mm-hmm.
It was sad, and I just never had that conversation. I kicked off at my. I just became a horrible person. I started going on sex sites a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And my ex's parents tried to get me to become a police officer. They was really pressuring in me that they kept on saying the word pension.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if I was going to become this pro comic, you know, and get enough work, pension, innit? Like, I didn't have a pension. So therefore I felt inadequate to them. Well, that's what I felt. And and the Met were recruiting, and they had this family friend or builder or something that was also a copper, and he was like, oh, come on a ride along. And it was quite fun. We had a ride along with the police. It's fun. And I was like, yeah, I'll apply, thinking I'll never get in. But I was doing it to please them. And I got in. Well, I got accepted, and had the interview, and you go for day one, which is like a maths and English test. And actually, I'm quite good now. Like, I know my limitations, and I know, you know, I'm not as scared as I was. I did the maths and English test.
Yeah.
Did the role play in, like, you know, situations. And, you know, I get accepted for day two, and I get start date.
Mm-hmm.
And day two is just like drug test and eye test, that kind of thing. And I get this start date mid-February, and then it comes back that I haven't got GCSEs.
Mm.
And I kind of...
It's like another door shut.
It was, because I kind of like, even though I never really deep down wanted to be a police officer, it was like you bring yourself, once you get accepted, you start bringing yourself, you start saying that bullshit like, oh, you get a pension, you know, oh, you know, good holiday, you know, and then it's like snatched away from me. And I remember saying to my ex's dad, I told him, I said, I ain't got GCSEs. And he just said, I don't believe you. And I was like, I just can't. I just felt utterly like a fucking failure. And I just became, after the police thing, and I was still working at the pub, I just started, I was getting no help from the doctor. The medication wasn't working. I didn't know where to turn. And I just started self-medicating myself in alcohol, in overspending on credit cards, money I didn't have, mm-hmm. buying shit, buying mm-hmm. rounds for people that I didn't know.
Yeah.
I was always like, yeah, I'm the happy-go-lucky guy down the pub, buying people rounds that I didn't know,
mm.
putting thousands on my credit card.
Because
I think at this stage, I was like, I think I'm done. I think I'm going to kill myself at some point. And I was suicidal. I was, like I said to you before, when you are suicidal, it's like you're drowning,
mm.
and you're under the water, you're submerged, you're kicking, you're panicking, you're swallowing water, and you just want to grab hold of something that's going to make you float. And I didn't know what was going to make me float.
Mm.
I thought it was going to be, I tried to go to the doctors and that didn't make me float.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to overspend and that didn't make me float. I was boozing a lot and that didn't make me float. Yeah. And the one thing left was sex.
Mm.
And I was like, fuck this. I was convinced that if I went to a sex party, I would get that. Because it was almost like a burden. Like, I always felt like, oh yeah, I'm kinky. I'm really kinky. I'm really open. Yeah. I'm really kinky. And it felt like I can sit there and say this shit and I know I'm the only one that knows where I was in this mental state. But I thought if I went to a sex party, it would make me a happier, better person. Because I felt like it was a monkey I had on my back, of like this kind of, I wanted to be, and I needed this kinky sex with like-minded people.
Yeah.
Because I was fascinated by it. You know, there's no secret to this podcast that sex has always been an escape for me, and I was going on sex, you know, at first it was porn, and then it was sex sites because that was a bit kinkier than porn. And then it was like always trying to find...
And you've both got it being something that's going to make you feel better, and then got this element of kind of increased sex drive that comes with bipolar.
It's quite common, right, with bipolar?
Yeah, it's extremely common.
And now I know that, but I didn't at the time. I didn't know I had bipolar.
Mm.
I didn't know any of this stuff. And I was like, in my head, I remember thinking, I'll go to this party and I will, and it was fucking awful, man. It was so, but like I went there, it was like
who did you go with?
I went on my own and I go there and there's this like, it's like a pub, but they've boarded up the windows and painted the boards black. They're blacked out. No natural light.
In London?
It was on the outskirts of London. And it was like, there was a fat man completely naked in nothing but a masquerade mask. Like, I can see your dick. Like, what are you hiding? Well, you don't want me to see like this part of your face. You're like fucking Robin. Like, what do you think's going on?
Right. And this guy is welcoming you.
Nah, he was just there. He sat up at a bar next to me and was like, right, what are you here for? And I was like, what the fuck do you think I'm here for? I'm not here for the bar snacks. And why the fuck is there was bar snacks? Who's going to sex clubs and eating ready sorted crisps?
Sometimes you just need
No, man, I'm not eating your dirty ready sorted crisps. But it was...
So when you were there, what were you like, excited? Were you like, what was going on?
I wasn't excited. At this stage, I had kind of stopped caring.
Bit numb.
That's where I was a bit numb. I was like, and I was hoping that participating in some kinky activity was going to thaw me out.
Mm.
Was going to make me feel a bit alive again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
that's, you hear that a lot as well with people who self-harm.
I think going to a sex party behind your partner's back is pretty much self-harming in a way.
Yeah, obviously there's lots of different sort of variations on it, but kind of if you think of the kind of classical form of cutting, one of the reasons that people end up doing that is to feel anything.
Yeah.
And in a sense it's grounding, and that, the same with sex. It's such a physical act and it kind of brings you back into yourself.
Yeah, yeah. Sex is always, I always think like sex makes you feel good, right? When you're having sex, you feel good, and for all that moment when I became numb inside and I was, you know, fascinating about suicide. Like absolutely like, oh, look at that. It was like a beach holiday that I've always wanted to go to the Caribbean. It was like, oh, one day, you know?
100%. Suicide Island.
100%.
So you're like fantasizing out.
I'm gonna be eating a mango and just drift off and never come back. It's fucking tough. It's tough to talk about because this period of my life is the darkest period of my life, and it will be the darkest period of my life ever because I'm determined to never let it get that dark again. But I went there and I did it and it didn't make me feel alive. It didn't make me feel happy.
Yeah.
It made me feel worse. It made me feel like just guilty and...
You can see it on your face now.
And I just, after that, for want of a better term, I became a bit of a monster. I just stopped caring about everyone and everything, and I kicked off at one of my closest friends' engagement party.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, it wasn't fully all down to me. That was really horrible, actually. But I regret doing it. But there was a girl there that I had a run in with like 4 years previous. Not even me, my ex had a run in with, and her and her friends were like pointing and making, it was like being at school. It was horrible. And I was like suicidal at this stage. went out to the garden, and she just said, like they were all saying stuff over the garden to me, like, why are you here? Like, no one wants you here. No one likes you. Look at your clothes. And I was like, that's the shit that I've been thinking.
Yeah.
You know? But not in a humorous way. It was like, it was fucking horrible to hear. Yeah. But it backed up what I've been thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember just putting myself back into that, like I will never say that those girls knew that I was suicidal. That's impossible for them to know.
Yeah.
But they didn't not know that. They didn't not know that. And there was no reason to act like it's hot. There's no other word. Horrible. That's what it is. That's horrible.
Mm.
Right? Nasty. And I started smashing a bottle on the table, and I just completely lost the plot.
Mm.
And I had to be kind of escorted out of my own best mate's engagement party.
How were you after that?
I became very good at this stage of all stuff, all negativity and anything horrible that was happening in my life and anything that I did and guilty for. I became like, it was water off a duck's back.
Mm.
I became, like I said, this monster. I became I became a womanizer in the pub.
David Alfie Ward, a womanizer?
No, and I don't believe that for a second. But, you know, after I went to that sex party, I was guilty, but it was like when you're on a diet and you have the chocolate cake.
Yeah, we were talking about this, weren't we? Yeah. Like when you're on a diet and you have one bite of chocolate, for me it'd be chocolate, I can't help myself.
Yeah.
And then it's, and you're just like, fuck it. Well, I'll just eat the whole fucking cake.
And after that, it was like, fuck it. I'll just eat the whole cake.
Because yeah, you're just like, I've done it now.
I've done that. And I became this character in the pub that I was working. I'd go in, I'd become a character. It was like as clear as I've ever done acting. And, you know, I've been lucky that in recent months, I've been doing acting. And it is, if I look back now, they're very comparable. When I became Tommy for this thing I was in, pilot.
Yeah.
And it was like that. I became this womanizer, this charmer. Every woman that came to the bar, I had, you know, laughing and flirting with and, barmaids and...
And you were probably getting quite a lot of like...
Oh, the endorphins were...
Yeah.
It was like one of the only things keeping me alive.
And if you think about, just to reflect on like what we've heard as well from the previous episode, just the kind of the number of knockbacks that your self-esteem has had through the years, like, you know, you've got difficulties in school, you don't know what you're doing after, you want to do something but maybe been told it's not the right thing, like you're worried about your weight, you'll come back from the tour, like you're not getting the comedy jobs, you've got your ex's dad being a dick, like that's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot for someone who doesn't have a mental health condition.
And I just became, this, you know, and it was almost like, look at me, can have all these girls, you know, and it's like, and I'm looking back, I'm not proud. I'm not proud at all, but I was in such a, it's keeping me alive a bit, and I would go back, but then I would be like so guilty, and my, I just didn't know like where to turn or where to run. I felt utterly helpless. I would, one of the assistant managers at the pub, Thomas, used to do line clean, they have to clear out all the pints before they clean the line, so you get all these free pints that are in the pipes, right?
Yeah,
that would only happen like once a month. But I was doing line clean all the time. And that's because it was an excuse to leave at midnight. So I would lay awake. And I would drive. We didn't live far from the forest. Walk around the fields, screaming, shouting, slapping trees. Like, I'm surprised. I used to do this so often. I'm surprised there's not like a YouTube phenomenon of like the screaming trees of Epping Forest. You know, like people are like camping out. Can you hear the trees screaming at night?
The tree,
you know, like, yeah. It's, you know, like, is there a Yeti? And it was just me. It was just a nutter in sliders slapping up trees. And And that was, and then I would do that and I would get back in the car and that was gone. And it was like, it was the worst,
yeah.
It was the worst part of my life. It was,
yeah.
You know, and I'm not proud and she didn't deserve that and she'll never will. And, you know, and it's taken me, you know, I don't know. I don't want to talk about that.
Yeah.
But, you know, and then.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm fine. And it's, you know, and then I was getting like, you know, I was getting a little bit of work by the end of 2018, you know, comedy work, doing more fighting cock stuff and yeah. And I got a tour of Oman.
Mm.
Yeah. I got a tour of Oman and, tours are great, but like I honestly owe so much to stand up comedy as an art form. Mm-hmm. Like it's made me who I am, but I honestly it's given me meaning and just the opportunities as well. Just like a lot of them places I've been to, I've gone there to make people laugh. Like no matter what the fuck I was going through in my life, I could still get on stage and make people laugh.
Yeah.
And I owe so much because I think the art form, and my ex to some degree, because I did love her, you know?
Yeah.
Despite how I behaved, I did. They were keeping me alive.
Yeah.
You know? And the fighting cock as well. And I get these tours. I'm still getting these overseas tours.
Mm.
Like, do you want to come out to Oman, you know? Do some, like, do a week in Oman, do some shows, 5-star hotels, you know? And tours are... tours will always leave you to a full sense of security because you get flown out, you get like a chauffeur pick you up at the airport, you get a 5-star hotel, free drinks, free food.
Mm.
You live like you're a rock star.
But you've got to come back down to earth.
And you've got to come back down to earth. You know,
that's a hard hit.
It's a hard hit for someone that was kind of didn't have bipolar.
Yeah.
And
also, like, just taking a minute, like, what people will have seen of you at that time. Sounds like no one would have really known.
No, not at all.
And it's important to point that out because thinking about, you know, if you know people around you, they might seem like they're fine, but it's not.
No, I was really not fine. Yeah. I go into the tour, it's great. We, it's me and a guy called Craig Campbell, who's a Canadian comedian, pretty famous, been on like Michael McIntyre's Roadshow, and a guy that I actually used to watch a lot when I was 16. So like him, he had this routine. So now I'm like touring with him. Like we're just getting fucked up and just being lads. And, and then on the night before I was about to fly home, my ex, I had gone down my laptop and found some messages.
Mm.
And I was banged to rights, yeah. I just confessed anything.
Mm.
Confessed about the sex party and stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
And I had to wake up. I never didn't get a wink of sleep. And I contemplated killing myself there.
In Oman.
But then I was like, my mum would have to pay for my body. Get extra tired.
Practical.
So I was like, I just, you know, I've got this flight anyway. And it was the worst flight of my life. It was the worst flight because I was on the plane 9 hours, 8 hours. I don't know how long it is, remember. Yeah. And you're up there in the, no internet, no nothing, just your thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And I told Craig, actually, I said, I've got a stomach bug. But I didn't. It was like, he was like, you're not. I was like, I've got a stomach bug.
Yeah.
And I went to my sister's. I flew back to London. My sister's in Walthamstow.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew what I was going to do. I just wanted to leave my stuff there. I wanted to say bye. I went into my nephew's bedroom. And I said, be good for your mum. And I never say that shit.
Mm.
My nephews don't care. They were like, yeah. I never get like, my nephew like, my nephew Charlie's on the autistic spectrum, and he just looked at me like confused, like, yeah, all right, like, so.
But that is like such a line, isn't it?
Yeah. And then I walked to the station. I said to my sister, I'm going to my mate Joe's house, and Joe lived on the other side of the station. And went to Joe's.
Mm.
I went to Wood Street Station in Walthamstow, and I sat on the platform, cried. But I went right down the other end of the platform.
Mm-hmm.
So I went near people. And and the train approached, and I saw it coming. You know, it comes around a bend.
Yeah.
And I saw it coming. It's an overground train, and I saw it coming around the bend, and it didn't deter me. It's not like that I, you know, like I saw the train. I was like, fuck, wake up. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And the plan was I stood up, I closed my eyes, and I walked.
Because
I knew I would fall, you know, I'd fall off the platform onto the tracks.
Mm.
And a guy pulled me back at the last minute. My elbow hit the train. That's how close I was.
That's fucking.
And I know nothing. To this day, I know nothing about that man. And I he got on the train. I know nothing about that man. He was wearing. I remember looking at him because he stood out, because he was quite a tall man, bald head.
Mm-hmm.
He had camo, trousers.
Yeah.
But a high-vis jacket. I was like, do you want to be seen or not? And he had two chihuahuas.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, he had two, and it just didn't fit because he was this big, tall, skinhead man, and he had two chihuahuas. And that's the guy that saved me. It's like being saved by Hawkeye out of the Avengers. You don't want to be saved by Hawkeye. You don't tell your friends about that. You want Iron Man.
I just love that he just got on the train.
He jumped on me. He shouted. Somebody shouted. And then the attendant come.
Yeah.
That was working at the station. A guy called Lloyd. And now I still see Lloyd, still works there. And we spud each other every time I go on the train.
Nice.
And the police were called. Joe was alerted because I think just I sent a voice note to my ex saying goodbye.
Mm.
And then my phone was off. And he obviously contacted my sister. My sister said he said gone to Joe's, and Joe put his trainers on and came looking for me. And Joe saw me surrounded by police, and he came up and hugged me.
Yeah.
Then he went, there was a shop opposite, and he went in and he bought me a can of Coke and Kinder Egg.
Legend. Did you keep the toy?
Yeah. No, I didn't. A little spinny. It was a rubbish toy. It was a good toy. I kept it. I was then detained by the British Transport Police.
Yeah.
While they called around, sat in the back of the car, while they called around looking for a mental health bed in London. They called every hospital, like as far as Croydon.
Mm.
And
the wilderness.
Yeah. And no one had a bed. So they just drove me to the nearest A&E.
Yeah.
And sat me in an A&E bed. And then the doctor was like, what's he doing here? We can't help him, and discharged me at 2 a.m. to walk home. The police couldn't give me a lift home. The police said, we're not allowed. So I walked home. Walked back to my sister.
That's a lot.
And yeah. And then I moved up to Norfolk. Well, I didn't move initially. It was like, oh, my mum retired in Norfolk. And she said, you got to come up here. It was early December. Like, come up here for Christmas. And I was like, yeah, but I just couldn't wait to get back to London. I had to get back to London. I had gigs in.
How did you feel about being saved?
It was all a, it's a hard one because it was all a bit of a blur. I don't remember feeling anything that makes, I don't remember feeling angry or happy, or I remember just, it was almost like it wasn't real.
Yeah.
You know, like I was sitting in the back of this police car and it just wasn't real. This ain't really happening.
Yeah.
That's how I felt. Never really thought of it. So I move up to Norfolk and I'm going back and forth to London all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had some shows and I shouldn't have been going back to London. That's when we met. I had some shows between my two suicide attempts. January. Did the Top Secret Comedy Club. You chatted me up and the rest is history. We know all about that. Said I was the funniest on the bill. Very funny. Hilarious. I'm very talented, babe. I'm very good at my job.
I'm pretty sure you were like, oh, were you at my show? And I was like, no.
I knew he was at my show. I know one. I'm that good of a comedian. I scowl audience.
You noticed his face.
And I was like, oh, he's at my show. Oh, cool.
No, you were like, oh, you were at my show.
People always come up to me and they go, he was really funny. And you go, was you at the show? I didn't even realise. Thank you. That means so much.
I actually, let's just make this clear. I didn't go up to you and say, you're really funny. You were like, were you at my show? Were you at my show? I was like, no.
Yeah, I knew you were at my show. You chatted to me because it was funny.
Yeah, you got nice eyes.
Yeah, that's true. And I'd come back anyway. I was going back and forth to London, after Christmas, and I was covering boxing. I used to cover boxing for an online page, and I was covering boxing fights. And it's funny talking about that. I found a picture actually just before I flew to Oman. Remember, I found a picture recently of me and a British boxer called Ted Cheeseman.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about, I went to a pub and I boozed all day after that. And that was a couple of weeks before I tried to kill myself. And you can tell it's quite eerie for me to look at it because I don't know how, but it's like shine in my eyes ain't there.
Mm-hmm.
It's gone. It's dead. Barker was dead.
Yeah.
And that was quite eerie to find recently. Yeah. And
where are you at with mental health services at this point? Because like you've been to the GP.
So I'm up here now. I'm up in Norfolk and I am temporarily at a surgery
registered
here.
Yeah.
And I'm just seeing GPs all the time, just crying, they're trying different medications. They couldn't give me like what I'm on now. It has to come from a psychiatrist. So it's like, they were just
still on antidepressants.
Yeah. Mind were there for me. So my sister contacted Mind at some point. I can't remember exactly when, but they were meeting me once a week for coffee, for peer support and stuff like that. And such an, and I'm not saying this because of, you know, where we are now, but such an amazing charity. But I wasn't good. I was just running down to London all the time and I just didn't give myself the chance to like
recover.
And that's, you know, we met and I was still chasing the night then. That was only a month before I tried to jump in front of a train. And now I'm like
a month after.
Yeah. Sorry. A month. Yeah. Sorry. It was only a month after that I tried to jump in front of a train. And now I'm still chasing the night. I'm still boozing. I was boozing some Irish girls all night.
Yes, you were. Yeah. By the way, when David Alfie Ward takes you on a date, he takes you to a pub to watch a Spurs game.
Don't ask me to go on a date if Spurs are on, innit?
I love... did I ask you?
Yeah, I don't know.
You're probably like, oh, come meet me after my comedy. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'm like,
fucking sat in the pub watching Spurs.
Well, no.
Did they?
Yeah. Anyway, let's be on the point.
We digress.
And I'm just not in a really, really good place there.
Yeah.
And then I'm back here. It's winter in the countryside. It's quite bleak. And news gets back to me that my ex is with somebody else. And it crushed me, like physically, mentally, and I hadn't recovered really from the first time. So I was like, I'm so done. I was like, I'm so fucking done. And I was like, why won't you let me fucking? And I remember I overdosed. I took load of diazepam, load of sleeping tablets, because I was on sleeping tablets from train incident because I couldn't sleep. I kept on getting flashbacks. I took them all. Diazepam, a load of heartburn tablets. I don't know why, if that was going to kill me, but at least I wouldn't go down with a bit of indigestion. Rennie. You know what I mean?
Get those
rennies and
in.
And half a bottle of rum, and I was like drifting in and out of sleep. My friend John Simmons, who I've never actually met at this point, he was just like a pen pal of mine. We got it was weird. I've got this pen pal.
John of course, Simmons. You have a pen pal.
Yeah, no, yeah, John Simmons, and. I called him because I knew he'd be awake. Left voice notes on Flav from the Fighting Cocks. I was monging in and out, and I just couldn't wait to die. I was like, I said to John, I'm gonna die, mate.
Mm.
I was like, sorry, I never got to meet you, but I'm gonna die.
You did you call him?
Yeah, I called him. Yeah, and he was like, you gotta go throw up. I was like, nah. And I did, but it wasn't a lot. And then I was found and taken to hospital, and my sister Jade took me to hospital.
So that call really saved.
Yeah, I called Aiden in Australia as well, my friend Aiden Jones, Taco, people know him. And he, I think, contacted family. Yeah, he probably saved my life. But he's an arsehole, so I would never give him credit for that.
Oh, okay.
Mm. A good arsehole, I love him too.
Oh, right. And this is the thing about people who are struggling with suicidal thoughts or, you know, making plans, wanting to act on it, is get yourself people that you can speak to about it, that you feel comfortable enough to ring. If it's not someone that you know, then there are so many services out there that can do that for you.
100%. I've used Samaritans, I've used Mind and Calm.
There's Shout as well. I think it's like a text one.
Yeah.
But just like that call saved your life.
Yeah. I'll never let Aiden know if he listens to this anyway.
Taco.
Yeah, he's all right. Getting actually pretty good at comedy. Well done, son. Taking your time, but you're getting.
That's patronizing.
Exactly how it was meant. But there we are. I luckily the what I took never got into my blood. Never affected my liver and killed me. And I remember taking it because I was like, I want a really nice way to die, in terms of like, I was in my mum's house.
Mm.
I don't want her to find me hanging or anything like that. So I was like, you know, just take these pills. You fall asleep, you never wake up. But apparently, I've later found out that very, very likely when you overdose shit and you vomit. So, you know, your mum's going to find you. Shit all over yourself. And
lesser of two evils, really.
It is the lesser of two. And there is help out there.
Mm.
And, you know, and I made a lot of mistakes and did a lot of things to get me to this point where I felt like I can't go, like, and it's not healthy that I've toyed with suicidal thoughts for a long time.
Mm.
And I still to this day do it.
Mm.
You know, but that's part of my condition and I've got to learn to adapt with that. But, you know, we've got to this point, and this is the second episode where, you know, I'm bearing all and I'm at the worst I've ever been in this episode. And I didn't think there was help, and that I thought there was no help. And, you know, and I tried to go to the doctor and it didn't work out. So I tried to medicate with alcohol, sex and spending, and none of it worked. And I felt that I was utterly helpless.
Mm-hmm.
And I can sit here now and say that there is help. There are services out there. There are people that care, and we're going to go into that in the next episode.
Yeah,
which will be the recovery, because I really do see my life as pre and post suicide attempt. You know, honestly, I think I'm a different person now.
Yeah, you are. You're different.
And we'll explore that a little bit and on the next episode of the help that I did get. And you know, because it wasn't easy. It took that second suicide attempt before I even saw a psychiatrist.
Mm.
And that's when I started to things started to go, but it wasn't like an overnight fix. Yeah. And we're going to talk about that on the next episode of like the medications, the trials and tribulations of different medications I was on and finding my way. And then, you know, and then we'll lead it up to today, really, the present day. But that's enough for second episode of, you know, David Alfie Ward, Bipolar and I.
I just want to say thank you for sharing it all with us. And I can see it was hard when you were talking it through. And for people that maybe have listened to this and found it hard, you know, take care of yourself.
Yeah, definitely. Like, there's always help out there and you're never alone. You're never, ever alone. And people care. And, you know, the next episode, we'll talk about, you know, my road to recovery and the help that I did get, you know, in terms of therapy and medication and psychiatrists and mental health teams. And I can't wait to share that all with you. So, but for now, take care. Look after yourself. And do you want to add anything, Laura?
Take care.
Not up the Spurs, no?
No.
All right.
Arsenal.
You have been listening to David Alfie Ward, Bipolar and I, a Cabin Fever original podcast.